This is the Stamfords podcast at the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival at Destinations in Olympia.
Coming onto the Stamford stage now, please welcome with Julia Wheeler, Leveson Wood.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival. Well done for getting here. Well done for getting a seat, those of you who have, and I hope that those at the back can hear. Welcome, Leveson Wood, to Stamfords.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So we've seen a little bit of, and I'm sure lots of people have been watching the programme on Channel 4, we've seen a little bit of what you've been up to. It's quite a different premise to walking the Nile, walking the Himalayas. Tell us about how you sold it, really, because it's not such an easy sell, is it, for TV or books?
Well, I think the concept really is taking a geographical region, a phenomenon, whether that's a river, a mountain range, or in this case, just a particular area, and exploring it on foot. And I think that's the concept that I've been trying to, you know, stick with. And by doing that, you meet people at the ground level. You meet people at the slowest way that we get around. And I think it's the kind of style that you do something as well, not just the physical handrail that you're following. For me, with Central America, the inspiration came from the fact that I kind of lived there for a few months about 6 or 7 years ago, just when I'd left the army, and then I did some jungle training there with the army as well. But apart from that, I'd not really explored that region as much as places like the Himalayas or the Nile. So for me, it was going to be a new experience all round. Good opportunity to practice some Spanish as well.
Yeah, how did that go?
Terribly. I had such a good translator, it didn't really matter.
But as you say, the thing that's unique, that's continual with the concept, is the walking.
Yeah.
And I wonder how, I mean, there's the obvious slowness to it and the fact that you're meeting people. Does it also ground you more? Is there a spiritual side to that as well?
I think there's two reasons for me with walking. One, it means that you can get to places that you wouldn't otherwise be able to explore. You know, on foot, you come across these communities and villages in the middle of the jungle or in the Himalayas that there simply aren't any roads, you know, that get there. So that in itself is quite special because you can actually arrive and see places that you wouldn't otherwise see. But also as well, I think by travelling at the same sort of speed as the locals in many cases and undertaking the same challenges and putting yourself at the same risks and vulnerabilities means that you're kind of seen less as a foreigner, as a tourist, because you're seen to be, you know, getting stuck in, and you're viewed more as just a fellow human being.
But you're also more vulnerable, aren't you?
Well, you are. I mean, I've had my fair share of scrapes along the way, but I think that's, you know, you accept on any expedition, you accept certain risks. And as I've discovered, actually, the biggest risks tend to be whenever you get in the car. So walking is actually the safe bit.
Just give us the background to that. There is an irony, isn't there?
Yeah, well, there is. I mean, I think with, you know, people think on an expedition that you know, the dangers are going to be getting eaten by a crocodile or, you know, shot at or anything like that. But the reality is, it's the boring things like, can you hear this, or is that really echoing? It's pretty bad, isn't it?
Everybody can hear, yeah? Okay, great. Okay.
But it's not those things that are going to get you in the end. It's literally getting in a car, and what happened to me in the Himalayas was the brakes failed and, you know, went flying off a cliff. But I was very lucky to survive.
But you hurt yourself.
I did. I broke my arm, yeah, and a few ribs.
So, thankfully, nothing along those lines this time. In terms of the dangers here, it struck me, that snake,
yep,
that went in the bag, didn't like that.
Snakes, I think, were everywhere I went in Central America, in the jungle. You know, people were always going on about snakes. In particular, there's one snake called the Ferdelance, which is a type of viper. And, you know, if you get bitten by one of these things, and you don't administer antivenom in sort of less than 12 hours, then you're a goner. So we were very, very lucky. One of our porters actually got attacked by a snake. It literally jumped out of a tree. And fortunately, he was wearing sort of baggy trousers, and the fangs got stuck on the trousers, so it didn't inject its venom. And what they say is that the baby snakes are the worst because they haven't sort of developed the knowledge to restrain how much venom they inject, so they just unload. So if you get bitten by a baby Ferdinance, you know, it's game over.
And what about the boa constrictor?
Boas I don't mind too much. They're big and they're quite terrifying looking snakes, but the reality is, you know, even if they bite you, they're not venomous. So as long as you don't get one wrapped around your neck, then you're okay.
Good. So I guess the other side of it that came out more in these series of programs than others were the human dangers. I mean, you put yourself into some situations that could have gone either way.
Yes, I think places like, I mean, if you mention Central America, certainly on this, for those that haven't travelled there necessarily, there are certain stereotypes and cliches, and I think people either think jungles or they think, you know, gangs and drug traffickers. And I wanted to try and go and challenge some of those stereotypes and you know, break a few cliches. But of course, there's no smoke without fire. And actually, what we did find in places like Honduras were quite, you know, quite a lot of gang violence. I ended up walking through a city called San Pedro Sula in Honduras. And this is a city that, between about 2011 and 2015, it was considered the most dangerous city in the world. It had more murders than anywhere else. I think they had almost 3,000 murders in 12 months. You know, so that's a lot of people getting killed. And it's a city, I think it's only about 600,000 people, so it's not an enormous city. And we did, you know, we saw all of these things. You know, we were walking through, we managed to get access through a local church pastor, and he was the guy to go to because he knew all of the police. He also knew the gang leaders on both sides. There's two main gangs there, and I remember, you know, we asked this guy, can you get us in? He said, yeah, no problem, let me make some phone calls. So he got on the phone, and before we knew it, he was chatting to the gang leader of both of these two rival gangs, both of whom were in jail. But, you know, that's how they run their empires, from jail, because it's the safest place for them. He spoke to the leader of one particular ruthless gang called Barrio 18, and the leader basically said, no, it's fine, you know, we can provide security, we'll let him come in and film, but just give us 24 hours to clean up the graffiti and the litter, which is a bit weird when you think, isn't it? You know, it's, yeah, a ruthless gang boss covered in sort of facial tattoos that actually he's more concerned about the sort of PR of his neighbourhood.
Wanted to create a good impression.
Yeah.
So one of the other things that's different about this journey was that you had the same companion all the way through.
Yeah.
Alberto. Tell us about how you met Alberto, a little bit about him.
So I met Alberto back in 2010. I was in Mexico trying to learn photography. So I bought myself a very expensive camera and got it stolen on day two. Which was quite annoying, but I was introduced to Alberto because he was a fashion photographer, and I went to his studio and he said, yeah, no problem, you can borrow whichever camera you want. So we became very good friends. He taught me the sort of basics of photography, and we kept in touch over the years. I say in touch, very sort of loosely in touch. The last I heard was his business went bankrupt. And he got married, and so we kind of lost touch for a couple of years. But when I rang him up to see if he, you know, if he knew any guides in the region, he was like, "Look, I've just got divorced last week. Can I come with you?" So I couldn't really say no to that, even though he'd never walked anywhere in his life, and he'd never been really on an expedition. So, but you know, he had the right attitude, and I think that counts for a lot when you're going through these sorts of things. You know, the rest of the practical skills, you know, hacking through a jungle, you can learn that, but having the right attitude, and, you know, much to the annoyance of the TV producers, you know, he didn't complain once, we never fell out, and it was, yeah, he was great fun.
It was quite a bromance, really, isn't it, between, there's good chemistry between the two of you.
Yeah, he was fantastic.
On the screen,
yeah.
Do you think he needs his own programme?
I think he does, yeah. I think Mexican TV should be snapping him up, yeah.
And obviously, it will obviously help with the language.
Yeah.
So who are the other people from the crew that walk with you?
So in a similar way to the Nile and the Himalayas, you know, a lot of the time it was just me and Alberto. I'd say sort of 50% of the time it was just us on our own. And then the crew would come into, you know, convenient points, wherever there's a city or an airport, they'd try and fly in for a few days or a week to, you know, get the nice, pretty shots. And then the rest of it is my very shaky camera work along the way. Yeah.
And he also took a camera as well, didn't he?
Well, because he's a photographer, yeah. It's sort of, you know, it's quite intuitive for him, yeah.
And how much then is planned before you go, and how in terms of what we see on TV, and how much of it is very much on the hoof and as you go along, and a little bit of luck?
Yeah, well, for me, I like to have that serendipity, and I think that's what makes these journeys special, is the fact that you don't know where you're going to sleep that night, you don't know where you're going to end up. You have a rough plan. You know, obviously, I kind of have a checkpoints along the way that I aim to get to on certain dates, because obviously, with a crew coming out, say in 2 weeks or 3 weeks, they've got budgets and things. They need to know that I'm going to be there roughly within a 2 or 3 day window. So you kind of plan that much, but the spaces in between, it's totally down to chance. And I aim to walk whatever it might be, 15, 20, 25 miles a day. Don't always make that. Sometimes a lot less, sometimes a little bit more. But in the space of a week, I kind of know roughly where I might be at the end of the week. You know, that's kind of how much detail I go into.
There is that tension, isn't there, between, as you say, the producers weren't delighted that Alberto was this cheery chap who had the right attitude. There is that tension between making the journey and making good TV. Because if things go wrong,
yeah,
that's conflict, that's story, that's great.
You know, for myself, I've been leading expeditions for quite a long time, both, with the army and after the army. I did some time as a sort of professional guide. So for me, my sort of professional instinct is to make things go as smoothly as possible and avoid any problems. But of course, it's an expedition. It's not without its risks. But you try and plan it to the nth degree. Obviously, TV, they need to plan the creative side of things. They want to know human stories, what kind of things they're going to see along the way. But of course, they love it when things go wrong. So there's always going to be that sort of, I wouldn't say conflict, but that clash at times of interests and agendas. So I'm forever arguing with my director as to what we're going to do, how we're going to do it. But, it's great because we kind of know now, this is 3-4 years in to this sort of project, and it seems to be working.
And is there also a tension between making TV and then having to come back afterwards, or having the delight of coming back afterwards and writing the book? Because are you looking for the same things in both those creative exploits?
It's quite different. I don't have a great deal of say over the TV edit. I kind of hand them the footage, and they do their magic in their little dark rooms, and they make a great TV program. For me, I write my own books. I sit there in my little office and scribble away, and I've got complete control of that. Sometimes the stories overlap, but I'm quite proud of the fact that actually the books go into a bit more detail and hopefully uncover a lot more of the background, a bit of the history, the geography, the reasons why, my own inspiration. So the book for me is an opportunity to just explore the region. Not just my own motivation, but the places that I go to in a lot more detail. And the sort of the two are quite separate in many ways. The challenge is, of course, doing it, obviously from a book marketing point of view, they want it to go out when the TV goes out, which means that I had to write the latest one in 5.5 weeks.
And tell us when you finished it.
On Friday.
So the book,
which is why it's not here at the moment. Sorry about that.
Well, we're fantastically lucky to have you here. We're sort of preview of your book tour, really. So the book is coming out on the 23rd.
Yes.
But if you buy either of the previous books, Himalayas or Nile today, then you will get a voucher from Stanford's for a discount. So sort of looking ahead as well. Well done for finishing it. I bet you had a beer on Friday night.
Yes, yeah. One or two. It's great. For me, it's great to see that the book when it comes together, because for a long time it's just a collection of memories and some scribbles that I can barely read in my diary. So to actually see that come together and form a book is a really special moment. So I really enjoy that. But of course, it's kind of all part of the same. The same project, the TV, writing. I do a lot of photography, and I've had sort of exhibitions of the photos and doing the talks. I've got a tour of something like 25 cities in 30 days or something coming up. So it's quite intense, but it's good to be able to share the journey and hopefully encourage more people to visit places that they wouldn't necessarily have thought about visiting. Mm.
So where did your original inspiration for going out there and finding the world and adventuring come from? Can you place it to a particular time in your childhood? Or a particular event?
Well, I remember, I think, my dad took me to it was a book signing and a talk not dissimilar to this when I was about 10 years old. And a gentleman called David Shepherd, who was quite a famous painter, particularly of African elephants. And I remember going to this talk and getting my book signed as a 10-year-old kid, thinking, wow, this guy's living the dream. You know, he's going off around the world at somebody else's expense, painting pictures of elephants. And, you know, that's what I want to do when I grow up. Couldn't paint, of course, so I had to find another way of making a living. But, you know, that I remember that as it was a sort of pivotal moment. But I think, you know, just a lot of things combined, you know, going away on a gap year at the age of 18, you know, I just never stopped having gap years, basically.
Where did you go on your gap year?
Oh, I did the usual. I went to Thailand and South Africa and India and grew my hair. Yeah, it was great fun. But I think, you know, it was moments like that, those formative travels that stuck with me. So actually what I'm doing now is trying to revisit a lot of the places that I did when I was much younger and see how things have changed. You know, I travelled through the Himalayas when I was 21, you know, all the way through Africa as well. So, you know, it's nice to go back and make those connections again and meet the people that helped me out when I was much younger. So I'm still in touch with a lot of the guides that I had when I was, you know, 18, 19.
And you had, I guess, professional training in army terms. How, it sounds like a daft question to ask, how much has that helped? And let me put it in the context of, if people are thinking of doing some of the expeditions that they've seen you do elsewhere or something similar, how expert do they need to be compared to your professional background of it?
Well, I mean, the army obviously gives you practical skills in terms of, you know, which plants you can eat, which ones to avoid. But having said that, you know, the practical skills you can learn in, I guess, any environment. Obviously, the army helps. I think what the army did for me was it just gives you the confidence to actually not be too scared and to appreciate what risk really means, because being surrounded by men with guns all day means that you kind of become attuned to when people are a threat, because the biggest danger is generally going to be drunk men with guns, you know. And so if you know how to appreciate risk, you're able to push the boundaries a bit more. And that's not to be reckless, but it just means that you can actually understand when there's a real danger out there. But, you know, it pushes you, you know, physically, mentally, you push yourself to the limits in the army, and I think that helps to just have the confidence to just go out and get out there. But I think, you know, anyone can do it. You know, what I've done is really just long walks.
Yeah. Make it sound so simple. I just went on a long walk. So are you, I'm presuming that you're still in touch with some of your army colleagues. What's their reaction to watching the programmes?
I mean, I get a bit of jip from my mates sometimes. But actually, a lot of my friends are in a similar business. You know, a lot of my friends go, what most people do when they leave the army is go and work as a sort of one of these risk consultants, basically a mercenary. But, you know, so actually and the great thing about the army, of course, is you then have a network of people around the world. You know, you can't go anywhere in the world without finding some dodgy paratrooper who's, you know, in a bar somewhere, which is useful because it means that you sort of, if you want to go to, you know, Outer Mongolia or, you know, somewhere in Patagonia or deepest, darkest China, you know, you sort of go on the network, you find out who the local guy, you know, manning the embassy is, and he's usually a para. So it's having that that network of contacts. And I think the key to all of my journeys is really the people that facilitate it, of course. You know, it's not just a case of getting on a plane, rocking up at the airport and going walking. You know, I do try and make sure that I've got people in place that if something bad did happen, then they can get me out.
And when you come back, how easy is it to adapt from that potentially dangerous situation where there is risk around you to normal life?
The mean streets of West London. Yeah. To be honest, I tend to sort of go headfirst into writing, and so I don't really have time to think about that adjustment period. Yeah, it's been quite busy the past few years, so I've probably not mentally computed most of what I've done. But I actually don't find it too difficult anymore. I initially did. I think initially I equated to it very similar to going away on a tour in the army. You know, you're going away, you're seeing sometimes, you know, difficult things along the way, extreme poverty. You become very humbled, I think. That's the thing. You come back and suddenly you can turn on a tap and drink the water when for the past 6 months you couldn't do that. Little things like that you suddenly become very grateful for. So I think that's the key for me is just trying to remember that gratitude, yeah.
From the walk in the Americas, which is the moment that sort of sticks in your mind? Which is will be, do you think, in 5 years' time, the thing that you look back and think, yeah, that summed it up, or...?
I mean, every day was different. It's so difficult to pin down those exact moments. I think I could probably pin down a few. I think Mexico, I think, diving in cenotes in Mexico was just incredible. I'd recommend it to you. If you can go and get a PADI certificate and just try diving in one place, then diving into, you know, abseiling down a cave and then suddenly being in this incredibly clear water, underground, it's very cool, very eerie. And then this is where the ancient Mayans used to do human sacrifices. So a lot of the caves are literally full of human skulls. So it's a very surreal experience, but it's something that, you know, if you can dive, recommended to do. That was very special. I think walking through the gangland areas in Honduras, I think that in itself was just weird, you know, and bizarre, sort of broad daylight, you know, kids with guns, and hearing these particularly horrible stories. And then the highlights, you know, places like climbing Mount Chirripó in Costa Rica, that was spectacular. It looked a bit like the Lake District. It was stunning. And then I think it's the people that stick out in my mind. It's those endless days on the road with Alberto, him just keeping me amused. And then the sort of very serendipitous moments, like walking, you know, the last thing you expect when you're walking through the jungle in Panama in the Darien Gap is to bump into four Pakistani lads who'd lived in London. And, you know, they're like, oh, yeah, hello, sir, how are you doing? You used to live in Croydon. Very weird, but it's great.
Yeah, so they were a long way from home.
Yeah.
And there were other migrants in the camp that you went
Costa Rica,
to along
yeah.
the way that were also a long, long way from home and almost without hope, actually.
Well, some of them, I think they wouldn't be there if they didn't have hope. I think, you know, that they had a hope, even if it was just a small flame, but I think they did have a flicker of hope that one day they would get to where they wanted to be. But yeah, very desperate for these people. It's very sad, you know, you see people that have been travelling with no money for 6 months. You know, it's incredible to try and put yourself in their shoes, and obviously, you know, you can't unless you've been there and done that. But the determination was fantastic. You know, I was very, very humbled to come out of that, having seen all sorts of people from all sorts of walks of life from around the world, you know, bent on trying to get a better life, you know.
You became very interested in the Mayan culture, and you touched on the fact that it was, with the sacrifices and so on, it was quite a harsh culture. But when you went up above the jungle on some of those pyramids, it was beautiful.
Oh, yeah. No, the... throughout that, I mean, everything north of Honduras has got Mayan ruins. And, you know, there's places, the sort of more famous places like Chichen Itza or Tikal in Guatemala. But, you know, you can go off the beaten track, as I found, you know, in the middle of the bush. And you ask the locals and they'll take you to these undiscovered pyramids that, you know, the local people know about, but nobody else does. You know, we found one in southern Mexico. That was it was bigger than Chichen Itza. It didn't even have a name. You know, it's covered by the jungle, and you know, it's a sort of archaeologist's dream to go and find these places. And they're everywhere, scattered throughout. You know, the ancient Mayan culture was a phenomenal civilization that, you know, until very recently was completely unknown. So, you know, for me, I'm a bit of a history buff, so I love going and finding those things along the way, and that's what makes it really special, to sort of just bump into these incredible pieces of architecture and art in the middle of nowhere.
And then you've got an excuse when you come back to research it more, pop it all in the book, and yeah, great. The other moment, I guess, when your face literally lit up was from the heat and the light of the volcano. That was spectacular,
yeah,
wasn't it?
Yeah, Nicaragua's got something like 20, 21 something volcanoes, and they are, you know, some of them like Masaya. It's just phenomenal. You know, there aren't many places in the world that you can literally walk to the rim of a volcano and look down into the pit of lava. So that was remarkable. But the scenery across all of these places, I think I have to say Nicaragua is probably my favourite. But the scenery is unbelievable, absolutely beautiful. Yeah.
And we saw in the opening credits that the Darien Gap was kind of. Was that on your mind, knowing that that was the final frontier, really? Was that on your mind the whole way through?
I think it was. I'd heard about the Darien Gap just from reading about it when I was much younger. And then there's a gentleman called John Blashford Snell, who basically in 1971 tried to take a Land Rover through the Darien Gap. And this was when it was a lot more forested than it is now. And it took him something like 4 or 5 months just to do a stretch for about 60 miles because it was so tough. So I met him about 10 years ago originally, and he bigged this place up in my mind, and it didn't disappoint, I have to say. It was pretty epic. I've got no idea how he managed to get a Land Rover through it, but no, the Darien Gap's always been this infamous barrier between North and South America. It's still illegal to cross over land between the two. We'd been badgering the authorities for months to see if we can get special permission, which we luckily got at the very last minute, but not without a lot of negotiations, and we had to go and see all the army commanders and things like that. So it was a big deal.
And you do that personally, do you?
Well, yeah, I mean, we had to physically go and see the army commanders on the ground along the way. Yeah. Obviously, we'd been making phone calls and emails beforehand, but, you know, you can't... nothing will stand in for a physical face-to-face. And until they look you in the eye, they won't say yes. So it was, I think we got permission 3 days before actually crossing. So, and that was a special place because, you know, you've got these very remote communities of indigenous Indians that live there, and, you know, they don't even go into the jungle if they can help it. So we ended up having quite a big team. I think we had about 10 porters that came with us. And out of those 10 guys, only two of them had actually ever been onto the other side of the mountain range, even though it wasn't more than 30 miles away. And so some of the younger guys from the village, because we went all the way to the coast, they'd never seen the sea before. You know, these Indians that lived like 30 miles away had never seen the ocean. So for them, they were all as excited as I was to go over the mountains and see the coast. They were pretty disappointed because when they got to the sea, when they realised it was salty and couldn't drink it, they were, we may as well go home.
It won't come again.
Yeah.
No. So we're going to come to questions in a moment, and I'm sure that there are plenty, but let me just ask you one practical question.
Yep.
Do you have an essential piece of kit that you take everywhere with you? Or, I mean, some people say I always take a sarong, some people say I always take a door stopper to go under the door for security. Is there anything that might be an unusual thing that you
wouldn't
be without?
Well, there's plenty of boring things that I could tell you, a compass, a map, a machete is quite useful in the jungle. But the one thing I always take with me is a clean white linen shirt, you know, Englishman abroad type stuff. It's important because you never know who you're going to bump into, or, you know, I spend a lot of time in the wilderness, but of course, when you find yourself in a town or a city and you're greeted by the local mayor or, you know, governor or policeman, you don't want to be, you know, in your rags, dirty and stinking. So I always carry one clean shirt, and it's come in useful very... You know, lots of times when I met the Dalai Lama in the Himalayas, and you know, in this instance, you know, when we got to Panama City, you know, it's a bit like Miami, so you can't be walking around in your sweaty, dirty jungle clothes. So I did find a great Hawaiian shirt though for that particular weekend.
Great. Okay. Well, let's get the microphone out, if we may, and can you stick your hands up if you've got questions for Leveson? There's a question just here to start with, and then we'll come to you in a second, and you next.
Okay, there. So, can you hear me?
Yeah, hold it quite close and speak.
Okay,
loud.
Can you hear me? Can you hear me better now?
Yes.
Where next?
Where next? That's a very good question, and I'd love some ideas because I don't know. I genuinely don't know. I've got about 5 or 6 ideas in the pipeline. But as ever, I always get a slap on the wrist when I talk about it, so I'm not not meant to say. But if anyone's got any good ideas, then do let me know.
Has anybody got any good ideas that they want to shout out? Russia? Did I hear Venus?
Venus. I'd love to.
Okay. You've got a question. Wait for the microphone.
Oh, sorry. Where is your dream place to walk?
My dream place to walk? Well, I've been very lucky. I've kind of walked the air. I mean, you know, the past 4 years, I've gone to three of the regions that I have always dreamed of walking. And so, yeah, I've been lucky. But actually, you know, I don't think you need to go halfway around the world to do your dream walk. You know, it's sometimes just nice to go for a walk along the Thames or wherever else. So I think the world's a big place. I think you can walk anywhere. That's the beauty of it. You know, you don't need to... you know, there are certain places, other places that you know, famous for driving or cycling. But actually, the great thing about walking is that you can do it anywhere. So I think go wherever you feel, you know, has that attraction. Thank you.
Okay. There was a question at the back there.
Yeah, hi. My name's Ray, and I've actually been through the Darien, so it's actually good to meet someone that's actually been through. Not many people have done it.
No, it's a small club.
Yes. Yeah. Definitely.
Have you got a question?
You.
No, just good to meet someone who's actually done the Darien Gap.
Well done, you. Thank you.
Thanks.
There's perhaps a question over there.
Sure. I was wondering how you made the transition between just them being your own adventures and turning it into a career and sort of the books and the TV and everything.
Yeah, that's a good question. So before I started doing stuff on TV, I was in the army for a while. And then I kind of knew that I wanted to write books. That was my own dream. And I thought, how do I do it? And I thought, well, I need to start earning some money because I spent up all my army wages on that camera that got nicked. so I was doing a bit of photography, weddings and babies mainly. That was fun. And then I kind of wanted to do more travel stuff, but I realized pretty quickly that it didn't pay very well. So I thought I'd use the skills that I got from the army. So I ended up setting up an organization that led, you know, as guiding, taking people away to potentially risky areas. And did that for about 3 or 4 years. Went to Afghanistan, Iraq, mainly looking after other journalists. So it was kind of organizing the logistics and security and things like that. And whilst that was great, because you know, I was taking other people away, I still had this sort of nagging desire to write a book. And it was on one of these trips we were making a film with Channel 4 in Africa. It was in South Sudan. It was like fishing in a war zone. And the director sort of came up to me and said, look, you know, you're going to these interesting places. If you've got any expeditions that you particularly, you know, want to do, why don't we pitch one of your trips? So I did. I thought, I sort of saw this great big river behind me, the Nile, and said, I'm going to walk the length of that. And he said, okay, we'll pitch it. And it, you know, luckily they picked it up. So I think that was a long, convoluted way of saying that I kind of spent a long number of years working behind the scenes in order to sort of get there. I mean, I never had really any particular desire to do the TV, but I thought it's a great opportunity and a great platform to do other things. And actually, it's been a brilliant way of undertaking this as a career. So yeah, cheers.
Thank you. Where's the microphone over here? Thank you.
Hi. Out of all the places you've been to, like, what's your favourite country?
My favourite country? That's a really tough one. I've been to, I don't know, almost 100 countries now. I'm not sure I could name my favourite one. No, I can't name it. I've been to a lot.
Did you have a favourite region?
No, I don't even have. My opinion on this is that you can go to an amazing place, beautiful places, but if you're with somebody who is a complete nightmare, then you're going to come back with terrible memories. Likewise, you can go to a complete dump, and if you're with good friends, you can have a great time. So I've always framed my journeys in that light, really. So it's kind of, you know, who you're travelling with and what the atmosphere is, rather than a particular place. I mean, they're obviously beautiful places. You know, I love South Africa. It's one of my favourite places because it's got everything, you know, mountains, deserts, jungles, all within a quite confined space. But likewise, Nepal, you know, it's a place that I've got a connection with. I went travelling there when I was 18, 19 and just keep going back. So, loads of places.
for lots of different reasons.
Yes.
Okay.
Hello.
Hello.
Could I ask you about your writing process?
My writing process, yeah.
Do you pre-plan or anything, or do you just write from memories and notes?
Okay.
Do you have somewhere you particularly like to be when you're writing?
So yeah, to answer your first question, I kind of do plan now. Yes, I guess I've got more of an understanding of what you need to do to fill 400 pages. To create a travelogue that's hopefully of interest, you know, because the problem with, if you've just got to travel, I mean, I do keep notes when I'm travelling, so I keep a diary, a daily diary, but it's usually, you know, walk 25 miles from this town to this town, saw a snake, had tacos for lunch. It's not really that interesting. So if I was to just write that out as a book, I don't think anyone would be sitting here today. So you then have to turn that into a narrative. And it's being selective as to what goes in and what doesn't go in. And obviously, you can't fit everything in there anyway, because if you're travelling for 4, 5, 9 months, whatever it might be, then there's a lot of stuff that you have to omit. So I think the trick is choosing what goes in the book. So I do have a process. I wouldn't call it a formula, but it's certainly a process of thinking about planning ahead. So I don't particularly go out thinking, I need to find this here, this here. You know, it's not necessarily journalism in that respect, but it's, I do have a little bit of a plan as to how I want the book to shape up like, yeah. Where do I write? I've got a little room in my house, a little study at the moment, which I write in. Last year I wrote the entirety of that book in a pub, because I had nowhere else to write it. So I don't think it really matters. You know, some people are very strict that they have to have a dark room that they black the windows out. But wherever you can.
You've just got to treat it like a job. You've just got
to be
there.
I mean, I'm quite disciplined. Yeah. So I literally write from 9 till, you know, 6 every day. I'd never write in the evenings, and that's me done. Unless I've got a 5-week deadline, so I did have to write a couple of evenings this time around.
Question here.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Very simple question. How do you manage to get travel insurance, and how on earth does it... How do you pay for it? How much does it cost?
That's the main reason I had to go into television, so that I didn't have to pay for it. Somebody else does that for me now. But, it's a tricky one, especially with... I've got quite a few premiums that have gone up since falling off cliffs and things like that.
How much is your excess?
Oh, how much is my excess? I've got no idea, but I imagine it's quite a lot.
I was going to say, actually, I mean, how long is the risk assessment form from Channel 4?
Ooh. Do you really want to know?
Yeah.
It's 90 pages for each assessment, and they do one for each phase of the journey. So probably every 2 or 3 weeks, they have to do another 90 pages. Yeah, it's pretty epic.
Question here.
Hello. How is Boston? We were a bit worried when he had to go home. Have you seen him since?
Boss, I have. I've seen him many times since. He WhatsApps me on an almost daily basis.
Just explain who he is.
So Boston, sorry, was my guide for the Nile journey. He came with me from Rwanda to South Sudan. Sadly, he had to leave me at South Sudan for a few reasons. One, he didn't get his visas approved. Two, he didn't speak Arabic, so it wouldn't be that useful as a guide anyway, going through North Africa. But we're still good mates. He came over, he's been over to the UK a couple of times, so I've shown him around. The first time he came, he'd never left East Africa, so his first time in London was quite an eye-opening experience. I remember when I was quite busy, I was doing all this sort of stuff, and he was like, don't worry about me, I'm a guide, I can look after myself. So I gave him his Oyster card, and the last I saw of him was going down the wrong way down the escalators at Charing Cross Tube as he was shouting, are you sending me into the bowels of hell? But Boston's great.
Great question.
Just whilst I wend my way over, can I nose in something you touched on there that I was wondering about earlier? If you wanted to go and explore a part of the world which is a path less trodden, do you need a translator?
Well, I mean, you don't need one, but it makes life a hell of a lot easier, I would say. And not just that, I find, you know, I've travelled on my own quite a lot. When I was 22, I hitchhiked on my own from well, Nottingham to South India. You know, and that was a great experience, and I wouldn't have changed it for the world. But I think these days I kind of like to have that, trying to get under the skin of countries a bit more. Having somebody that is either a local or at least can speak the language just means that you've got that connection, and especially if they don't necessarily need to know the way. I mean, you know, like I say, Alberto had never been outside of Mexico, so he didn't know the route. But that's my job. You know, I can navigate for him. You know, he was there because he was completely charming to get us out of jail, which he did on several occasions. So yeah, I think that that's more important. It's the language, but it's also just having that local way of understanding, I think. Yeah.
Thank you.
You've got to be fairly streetwise. Things that he may pick up on that you.
Yeah.
Hi. Hello. Is this going to be your final career note, or is there anything else you wish to pursue?
My final career. I don't know yet. Let's see. I don't know how long my legs will keep going for. I reckon I've got I don't know. Walking, maybe. Maybe not. You know, I love travelling. I don't think I'll ever stop travelling. But I think there's different ways of doing it. I don't know. Maybe people will start getting bored of my walks soon, so I need to do something else. We'll see.
How many is it? 4 million steps. Is that right?
I think the latest one was something like that, yeah.
4 million.
I wasn't counting every single one.
No.
Somebody did an equation somewhere.
And no one's going to go and check, let's face it. Christian here.
Hi there. Nice to meet you.
Hello.
I'm just interested in the language aspect of the journeys that you go to. Have you ever been inspired to learn the language or pick up certain words for the countries you're in?
I do try. I do try sometimes. I mean, obviously, you need to learn the basics. You know, I tried to I've been to Mexico quite a few times. So I did a Spanish class in Mexico a few years ago, so I understand the basics of Spanish. Whenever I go to a country, I'll make sure that I learn at the very least, you know, hello, thank you, how much for a beer, you know, those sorts of things. So yeah, I think it's very important just to be polite to learn a few words at least, but. You know, unless you're actually going to spend months and months learning a language, then, you know, I think it's important to have a translator with you.
How do you know how much money to take with you? And do you always have the right currency?
You can never have enough money to take, can you? actually, most places that I've travelled, certainly in Central America, you know, it's dollars all round. In fact, in Panama, they don't even have a local currency anymore. They just use dollars. So it's usually, the greenback is king, really. And, I mean, what I do, the tricks of my sort of going on expeditions where you're highly likely to get robbed is I get, you know, dollars, put them between two pieces of paper, laminate them, and then you've got like a sort of oblong that fits perfectly in between the insole of your shoe and your boot so that even if somebody takes your shoes off, you know, they can't see it. And also because it's laminated, it's then waterproof if you're going through rivers and things like that. So that saved me a few quid here and there. But, you know, in terms of money, you know, keep a few dollars in your wallet just in case it gets nicked. And, you know, but, you know, I don't think you have to worry about that too much. Money is, you can go somewhere with lots of money and spend it all. You can go somewhere with no money and not spend it all. The journey when I hitchhiked from the UK to India when I was 22, it took me 5 months. I spent a grand total of 750 quid, and that included the flight home. And that was just because I was kind of living. Yeah, it's easier when you're 22 because people will tend to feel very sorry for you and take you in. But, you know, you kind of, you know, people are very hospitable wherever you go. Sorry, I can't hear.
So we'll come to you in a second. Let's go here.
Have you ever felt in fear of your life, not in the army, but perhaps whilst travelling?
I think the 10 seconds before flying off the edge of a cliff in a car was probably what certainly up there. A couple of times with people in South Sudan, I found myself in quite a dangerous situation in the middle of a civil war. There was a you know, fighting going on in the streets, and the only way to hide was on top of the roof of a hotel. It was quite a surreal experience. At night time, watching, you know, the tracer fire blasting overhead, and you know, being surrounded by rebels. A couple of times, you know, I got robbed in Tanzania. Yeah, Tanzania it was. You know, a car just pulled up five or six guys got out, surrounded us, and you know, asked for some. You know, they wanted to rob us. They were like, "How much money have you got?" Boston was very quick thinking. Actually, he said, "Do you honestly think that if we had any money, we'd be walking?" And they were like, "Yeah, fair one." So they just nicked my hat and my belt instead. So yeah, a few times, but you know, you accept that as part of the risk.
We've got time for a couple more questions. Yeah.
Hi, Levinson. How long did the actual shoot take to make, and when did you make it? I'm talking about all the Americas.
What, the filming side of things?
Yeah.
So the program, the editing, well, I mean, it was ongoing. So whenever the crew came out, they would film for, say, a week. Then they'd take that footage back to London. They'd edit it as I was going. So actually, I didn't... And then my bit at the end, when I come and sort of...
How long were you on the road for?
Oh, sorry, the journey. Yeah. Well, this one, I set off in July and got back in December, so what's that, 4.5 months, yeah.
6 months or so.
Yeah, almost,
did
yeah.
you have any rest days, or was it just continuous?
Occasionally, yeah. Every couple of weeks you'd have a day off or something like that. Yeah.
Okay.
So the thing is, it's like at the beginning you plan, you try and plan it out, and you say every week I'm going to have, you know, a day off. It just doesn't work like that, because you kind of want the days off when there's an appropriate place. So if you happen to walk past a nice beach, that's the day you want the day off, not, you know, in some horrible suburb somewhere. So, yeah.
You got a bit of time in Panama City, didn't you?
Yeah, we had a couple of days off in Panama City. That was nice. Yeah. Enough said.
Okay, so I think that's probably about all we've got time for. I want to ask you one last question, which is, on this journey, what's the new thing that you've learned about yourself?
Ooh, deep. The new thing that I've learned about myself. I think, actually, I learned a lot from Alberto, because he, you know, he came out of a pretty rough spell. He got married and then less than 12 months later was divorced. And, like I say, his business had gone bust and all this. But you know what? He never lost his enthusiasm. And, you know, he set off thinking, you know what? This is a completely fresh start. I'm going to use this expedition as a way of starting again. And actually, I think there's a lot to be said for that. You can, you know, go away travelling and just view it as a clean break.
Great.
So it's quite inspiring.
You're quite deep yourself. Great, lovely. So Lev is going to be over at the book signing there. We've got copies of The Himalayas and Walking the Nile. As I say, there is a voucher here for £6 off when the new book, Walking the Americas, comes out on the 23rd of February. So please do go and continue the conversation over there. Thank you very much for some great questions. Thank you for coming out so early.
Thank you,
Levinson Wood.
Thank you very much.